The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 98 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is Tyler Perry, the 47-year-old actor, producer, director, screenwriter, playwright, author, songwriter, and movie mogul, who is the most commercially successful black filmmaker in history, and whose Atlanta-based Tyler Perry Studios now rivals any operation in Hollywood. Perry, of course, is most famous for creating, directing, and portraying on stage and screen the character Medea, an outspoken elderly black woman who tends to wind up in messy situations. Since 2005, 8 Medea films have been released, loved by audiences, and hated on by critics. This week, the 9th, Boo, a Medea Halloween, hits theaters, so it seemed like a great time to reach out to Perry to see if he'd be open to discussing his fascinating life and unique career. Over the course of our conversation, Perry and I discuss how he was shaped by his childhood, during which he suffered terrible physical and sexual abuse, how years later stumbling upon an Oprah episode motivated him to begin writing, what inspired the Medea character and what goes into bringing her to life, who the Tyler Perry audience is and why they're so loyal to him, what he thinks about the journalists and fellow members of the black community who argue that Medea is essentially a modern-day minstrel character, and how this man, who just a few years ago was living out of his car, became expert enough at branding and business to amass a net worth estimated to be near $500 million, built a 330-acre studio, and employed thousands of people. We also get the treat of hearing what Medea herself thinks of the 2016 presidential candidates. And, as you might imagine, it's quite hilarious. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mr. Perry, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Scott. My pleasure.
So to begin with, we always just ask, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
Born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. My the man that raised me was a carpenter subcontractor. He framed houses. And my mother worked at a Jewish community center taking care of kids there.
I have read in the course of preparing for this that though you go by the name Tyler, that is not your actual first name that you were born with.
Yeah.
Why did you change that?
Well, Emmett Perry is the name that I was given at birth, but it is the name of the man who raised me, and I didn't want to carry his name. It represented a lot of pain, a lot of screaming and yelling every time his name was mentioned, so I didn't want to be called by that name. Yeah.
And not to belabor this at all, but you've spoken about it in the past, and I think it shaped the films that you've made, so I just wonder if you can somewhat synopsize. I mean, it was not the happiest of childhoods.
Well, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. No. It wasn't a happy childhood. There was a lot of turmoil and pain and heartache, a lot of abuse at the hands of my father from him to me and my mother. And it was a difficult time, but every bit of it has formed the person that I am today.
So I imagine that throughout your childhood, you were probably looking forward to getting away from the home and probably New Orleans in general. How did you end up around the age of 21 in Atlanta?
Well, all through childhood, I had a very vivid imagination. I could go in my mind and be somewhere in another town, in another place. And a lot of times I would see myself in this big open field running in the grass. And at 21, I went to, it was spring break. And for black kids back then in the 90s, it was called Freaknik down in Atlanta. And, you know, white kids go to the beach. Black kids were going to Atlanta for spring break. I don't know why. Atlanta was hot as hell around that time. But when I got there, I wasn't even in college. I was just going to hang out and party. But when I got there, I saw black people doing well for the first time in my life. I saw black doctors and lawyers and people with who had, you know, my complexion living in nice homes and taking their families to dinners and going on vacation with them. Things I had never heard of, things that were so foreign to me growing up. I had never gone to a restaurant, you know, up until that time. I had never spent any time with family. We never sat around a dinner table. I had mm-hmm. never seen any of that. And I didn't think it was something that people of color did. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Atlanta, all those myths were blown out of the window.
So eventually you then moved back there not long after, right?
No, that weekend I went home, I packed my Hyundai and drove right back. I drove right back that weekend.
And within a year, I guess you were, from what I've read, working at a law firm, your bill collector, and mm-hmm. you see an Oprah episode?
Yeah. No, actually, I saw the Oprah episode in New Orleans. Yeah, I saw it in New Orleans where she said it was cathartic to write things down. So I started writing in New Orleans, and I started journaling there. And a friend of mine in New Orleans said to me, you know, I used different characters' names because I didn't want people to know that I was talking about my own life when I was talking about adult survivors of child abuse. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is a really good play. Well, he was murdered selling crack cocaine in his grandmother's house. And I remember taking the play with me to Atlanta, knowing that that is what I wanted to do. I wanted to make that play happen.
And so that play was I Know I've Been Changed.
Yes.
And from what I've read, you really poured your heart into writing it and then your savings into mounting it.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you thought that would go and then how it actually went.
Well, I assumed that I could do it all. I thought that I could promote it and write it and direct it and go out and work the concession stands and then come back and put the lights up and do everything I needed to do, but it doesn't quite work that way. And I learned very quickly that I did not have a gift for promoting. So I thought I would see 1,200 people over the course of a weekend, and 30 showed up. Yeah, so car payment, rent payment, my H&R Block tax return that wasn't quite done right was all invested in the play, and I lost everything.
And so those next few years were pretty tough. I've read about living in motels or even out of your car. What kept you going creatively, but just generally through those tough times?
What kept me going is my faith. My mother was a woman who instilled great faith in me. And no matter what was going on in our lives, she would tell me to pray. Everything's going to be okay. So from a little boy, I remember praying, talking to God, just saying, listen, I God, just help me here in this situation. And it was my faith and knowing that everything was going to be okay.
And your faith hadn't been shaken, though, by some of the crap that you had to deal with that you've talked about as a child?
Yeah, of course it would be shaken, but I just kept seeing in my mind a better place, which would always give me hope. Like that running in that park that I talk about, running in those open fields, I would always see that and it would give me so much joy. And all of those moments, especially when I was beginning to doubt and things were beginning to crumble, because the greatest frustration I had, honestly, was I did not know how I was going to make it. I saw it in my mind. I believed it, but there wasn't one bit of tangible hope or one person that I could say, this person is going to help me or that person is going to help me. And that was the most frustrating part of it all, not knowing how I would get there.
And so after that initial loss of your savings and lack of success with the original incarnation of that play, you just kept refining it over the next few years, or was it starting all over? How did you end up in 1998 basically turning it into a success?
Well, in 1992, I did the show and it failed with the 30 people coming, but there was somebody who wanted to invest. So I was doing one show a year after that. because that's all the investors could afford. But every time in the audience, this is how you know something is for you to do. Every time in the audience, there was someone who wanted to invest. So from 92 to 93 to 94, 95, 96, 97, one show a year, have to quit my job and go try to do this one show and hoping it would be successful. But in 1998, what I think changed was within those years of trying to get the show up on tour, I had some major conversations with the man that raised me, and I forgave him. Little did I know that the show was a bit prophetic for me, because the writing was ahead of me. The show was about people who had forgiven their abusers. And no sooner than I forgave him in late 97, in 1998, the show took off. And that's the only thing that I can attribute it to, other than what I attribute it to is my understanding of the words that I was speaking. They became life to me, you know, and they became power in my own life to have. I think it's very important that before you can go out and give the message to someone, you have to know it and receive it yourself as well. So
that's amazing that you were able to do that. And the show becomes at this point a phenomenal success. I think you had by that point figured out more how to be a good promoter, because it was throughout Black churches and areas, right? And so following that success, what were those next few years after that like? You were now a prolifically creative guy, I think, right?
Yeah, but they were scary. I still had a lot of residue from being very, very poor. So everything was about hoarding. Let me get as much as I can and put it away. I've got to build a house and pay for it. So if this goes bad, I've got to make sure the car is paid for. So everything was about, this isn't going to last.
Right.
Once I was able to, after the second year of success and the shows are selling out all over the place, I started to relax a little bit and go, wait a minute, this is actually here to stay.
Yeah.
They're loving it. And once I was able to do that, I was able to embrace being successful and having success.
And one of those shows of many that came after 1998 was the one that introduced Madea. Can you talk about just when and how that character was born?
I had done Old Man Joe, my character. He was the first one in an orbit change, and people loved him. I said, well, this time I want to do something different. And I saw Eddie Murphy do The Clumps, I think it was.
The Night Professor,
when he's being one of the clumps. I said, I'm going to try my hand at a grandmother character. And there, Madea was born. And I modeled her after the funniest women that I know, my mother and my aunt. And they were women who took no prisoners, who said what was on their mind. They weren't politically correct. They would just say it, kind of like Donald Trump. And I made that them my focus. And the person that was supposed to be in the show, I had been advertising her all week that she was going to be there. I had spoken to her manager. She was on her way. She had a big hit record on the time, big R&B star. And she was supposed to be in the play when we hit Chicago. Well, she never showed up. And I was devastated. So there I am playing Madea. I was supposed to be on stage for 5 minutes. But when she left, I had to take her lines and Madea's lines.
So you were not originally going to be Madea?
I was going to be her for a very small time. She wasn't going to be as large as she became. And at the end of the show, I walk out on the stage. I get a standing ovation from the audience, which blew my mind. And I'm apologizing for her not being there. And the audience says, they're chanting, we don't care. We don't care.
That's great.
And that's Madea was born.
Now, not all straight men are confident enough or comfortable enough in their own skin to dress in drag, I guess you would describe it as. Did doing so ever give you any pause, or was it you were at home right away in that?
I never looked at it that way. I look at it, the people say, oh, you're dressing in drag. For me, it's like the people at Walmart who put the jackets on to go to work. I mean, that's what it is. It's like my uniform. It's
right.
Okay, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a character actor, so any character you give me, I give my all to it. I look at Alex Cross, which was, you know, when I was out doing rides with police officers and talking to criminals and the darkness of it, trying to get into it. You just go with it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was clear, though, right away that there was a response to Madea that was larger than the response to some of these other characters?
Well, there had only been one before, and it was
only
Joe.
Okay.
Only Joe. No, he had a very large response. But no, Madea, there was something that was just happening with it. And I was like, wow.
That was, I guess, in probably the early 2000s. By 2003, you were shopping around, as I understand it, the concept of a film in Hollywood built around Madea, I think built around Diary of a Mad Black Woman. And studios were not too enthusiastic at that point. In fact, some I think were pretty rude.
Oh yeah. One guy in particular, at one of the big studios. I would go into these meetings because I signed with William Morris at the time. Wow, it's been that long I've been with them. They were taking me around to all these meetings, and we had done the show, and, you know, I'm thinking, I'm famous among black people, man. I cannot walk down the street in the South, right? I get here to LA and these guys are like, who the hell are you? And what do you want? And what can we do for you, kind of thing.
Right.
It was quite interesting.
Right.
Quite interesting.
So you really pretty much exhausted the rounds here until Lionsgate, I guess, was more receptive, or how did that come about?
No, I think I went to three or four people and then I said, I'm done. I'm going to do this on DVD because I had done all the films on DVD. I said, I'm going to do this movie on DVD and sell it on my website like I've done everything else. And I was doing OTT before that was OTT. So right. So I was like, to hell with it. I'm not dealing with these people.
Right.
And Lionsgate called. And when Mike Pasternak called, I had such an attitude. I was like, listen, I've been out there. I've met with all these people. I'm not changing anything in the script. I'm doing it my way.
Right.
I'm going to put up half the money. I need to own the copyright. And at the end of the conversation, he says, okay. I thought, well, now, okay, here we go.
What did he get that the others didn't get?
Believe it or not, D.L. Hughley was around, and he's like, have you ever heard of this guy, Tyler Perry? See, Mike was smart enough to go talk to somebody black to see. And DL was like, the guy is huge in our community, huge. And he also had some other black people working there at the time, and he asked them about me, and they all were just going on and on about it. So he did his research the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. So bottom line, you and Lionsgate, I believe, split the budget, as you say. You had...
Oh, they didn't believe in it. Let me tell you what they did. We split the budget 50-50, and then they took another 50 and split it with BET. Yeah, so they had no... They were like, we're going to protect ourselves.
Right. You, though, retained complete creative control, and so the result was that this $5.5 million movie opens in February 2005, number one at the box office, $50.6 million domestically, and basically shocked everyone in Hollywood. And I guess I just wonder... Were you as surprised as everyone else, or did you kind of truly believe that was going to happen?
Oh, I knew that would happen. I wasn't surprised because I had been out on stage in front of the people, man. I knew they were coming. You know, I was out like on a campaign trail week to week seeing, you know, 30,000 people a week saying, listen, we want you to go see this movie. And I would show the trailer and they would go crazy. So I was expecting something wonderful to happen. And I think the tracking said it was going to be really, really soft. And it was Oscar weekend, if I'm not mistaken. And come Monday morning, when everybody looked at the paper, they were like, what the hell happened this weekend? Yeah, who is this? Where did this come from?
Right.
Yeah.
So who is the Tyler Perry audience?
It's evolved a great deal over the years because what I found, especially as of late, is that now these millennials, they can find you online and become an expert on you in 2 weeks. So I've watched my audience change, but I can definitely tell you who my base is. My base are hardworking people, mostly African-American, largely women, who have all kinds of jobs, all kinds of, you know, they are working at Walmart and McDonald's, they own hair salons, or they're doctors and they're lawyers and they're judges. And I've seen some of everyone. And I think what makes it work is it whacks nostalgic to times of old. So no matter where you are on the social ladder or in the ladder of class, you still can relate to some of the characters. So That's a pretty good cover of a lot of my audience.
And what percentage of them would you estimate are very religious people?
In the beginning, I would have told you at least 95%.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think it's a good 50-50.
Really?
Yeah, I really do.
You, again, seem to be honing this. You said you started out as a bad promoter, marketer, but starting with even that first film, you were savvy enough to insist, I guess, that it have Tyler Perry's ahead of the title. And that's been the case ever since. Where did that start? Where did that come from that was important?
You know, I was told I was arrogant. I was, who do I think I was? Because I remember showing up in one theater and my name wasn't on the marquee and I had a fit and made them go out there and put it up before the show started. And people were thinking, this guy's got a crazy ego. But for me, I was definitely building a brand. The reason I wanted to put my name on it is because there were a lot of shows for the African-American audience at that time, like the live stage shows. And in theater, the name was always of Garvidal, so-and-so,
yeah.
So-and-so. In theater, it was always above the title. But what I also realized is that if I put my name here, they'll know that when they see Tyler Perry, they're going to get something different from the others.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't have called it building a brand at the time. I didn't know that, but now I know that's what I was doing all along.
Yeah. To come back to Madea specifically for a second, can you explain let's pretend there's somebody listening who's never seen one of your films yet.
Yeah.
who is Mabel Simmons, and how did she wind up with this name Madea, and what is the appeal of this person?
So for someone who's never seen it, Mabel Simmons is a loud, obnoxious, tough-talking, gun-toting, weed-smoking grandmother who is unapologetic, who is not politically correct, who was born in the late 40s and says what's on her mind and does not care. And I think that's what the appeal is, because no matter who you are, if you're Jewish, if you're Italian, if you're Latino, if you have a grandmother or grandfather somewhere in your lineage, you know this character. And I think that's the appeal, because she was always wise. This grandmother was always wise. And she's not around anymore. Grandmothers are much younger, and they look much younger because of hair dye. But she had so much wisdom. She was so smart. She was so full of love, but she's also a fixer. And I think that's why people wax nostalgic to it. I think that's why she's been so popular.
What is the process of turning you into Madea entail? How long is that? What do you have to go through?
It's gotten a lot better. It used to be like hours to get into the makeup and hair, but with digital touch-ups on screen now, I can do it in about an hour.
Really?
Yeah, we get in and zip the costume up and go right out there and do the character, but it's a chore. It's a chore. The most difficult part, I would think, about the character is directing in costume. Standing there in costume, not changing, telling people what to do, where to put the light, where to move the camera, what lens to use. Yeah, in my normal voice, in the wig and everything. But my team has gotten so used to it. It's been so many years that we've been doing it, so it's comfortable.
Another thing that was kind of interesting to learn was that you guys, with your films, unlike most films, but like a lot of sitcoms, do the four-camera setup?
Three for me on the film.
Three now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's because I'm guessing you do a lot of improv and you want to just not have to try to recapture the magic?
Yeah. When you're doing comedy, you have to, especially with me, and it's rolling, you want it to just roll. You don't want to be able to cut. You don't want to have to set up again because you lose the momentum.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. So with that first Madea film and with the others that have followed, she goes to jail, survives a family reunion, celebrates Christmas, now survives Halloween. What are the overall aims? I'm sure entertaining is high on the list, but what else are you hoping to communicate in each of these films?
Well, if you look at all of them, there's this one theme of faith, family, forgiveness in all of them. It always finds its way in. I don't want to just do movies to just do movies. I'd like to leave people with something that would lift them in some way or another, that makes them laugh, that encourages them in some way or another. But for the most part, it's about those three things, faith, family, forgiveness. So they're woven into all of them.
And are these cathartic in the same way that writing in that initial post-Oprah episode phase was? Because, I mean, even here in Boo, a movie about Halloween, there are discussions about parental abuse of children and all kinds of things that are actually part of your experience. So is that as much about getting stuff off your chest as it is about helping other people?
Well, I don't know if it's about getting things off my chest anymore as much as it is about what I've learned. What I've learned and how I can use it to speak and lift and encourage as well. Even in my television shows, it's a lot of those moments about what I've learned and how can I use this, I hate to say platform because it's become such a common word, but how can I use this platform to not just entertain you, but also leave you with some thought that makes you go, am I like that?
Mm-hmm.
Or could I be better?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The origin story of Boo is pretty hilarious. I wonder if you can
within
share
itself,
that.
Right?
Yeah.
Chris Rock does this movie, Top Five, and in the movie, he has a fake. First of all, his character does movies in the movie. So try to follow me here. And his character does a movie about a bear. I can't think of the name of the movie. So he decides, he and Rosario Dawson's character, they decide to go to the movie, Rosario's character, go to the movie theater to see who's at his movie. Well, when he walks in, he looks to the left, and he sees a long line trying to get into a movie theater. And he asks the people, what is this movie for? And they say the title of it is Boo, a Madea Halloween.
Big laugh line, right? Everybody's laughing.
Right. Really? Madea? This many people going to see Boo? So, of course, he had to call to get permission to use the character and everything. I was like, you know, Chris, I'm a huge fan, so I was totally happy to oblige. So now it's time to turn the favorite. So Lionsgate sees it, and they go, Tyler, we need to talk. Yeah, okay, what? Did you see Top 5? Yeah, it's great, man. I love the movie. No, did you see Boo and Madea Halloween? Yeah, I'm like, yeah, isn't that ridiculous? That's so ridiculous, Boo and Madea. Madea will never do Halloween. They're like, well, have you thought about it? I'm like, are you really asking me to do a movie called Boo a Madea Halloween? And it took me 2 years to sit. And nothing takes me 2 years, man. No. I could send a kid off to college in less time. But I was really thinking about it and came up with a concept that works for me.
one thing I want to jump back to, because you've now been playing Medea for something like 15 years?
Almost 18.
18 years. Yeah. I wonder how long into the future you can see yourself playing this character. I understand that when your mother, who inspired the character in some ways, when she passed away in 2009.
Don't stop playing Medea, yeah.
Why was it so important to her?
She loved her. Yeah, she loved her, and she loved the laughter. And she said, baby, whatever you do, don't stop playing Medea. I was like, I sure hope that's not your dying wish. but she did say.
Because would you still be playing her if she hadn't said that?
You know, I tell you, it's what it does for the people. And I assure you, man, I have been able to use this character to bring messages to people who no one has been able to get a message to. She can talk about anything. She can make them laugh. And it's so disarming. It's like anesthesia to get to the root of everything. If I could find a way to talk about police brutality and all of these people being shot by police officers through this character, and I've been thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
I think it would speak volumes to what so many people can't say, you know?
Yeah.
So she's been an effective tool, but I am determined to not be her age playing her. Yeah, I'm determined.
Would you ever empower, authorize somebody else to play her?
Are you kidding me? That would be like saying, here, take my arms.
Right,
yeah,
right.
No, I need my arms.
Right.
That's like a kidney transplant.
Right.
No, I'm going to keep both of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned how this character's been able to reach almost every group out there, every type of person out there. If there's one type of person that it has not reached for whatever reason, it might be some critics.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, because I've read you talk about this in very humorous ways before, mm-hmm. just what is the divide there? Why do they give you such a hard time?
I'm sure there are lots of reasons. Listen, let's just be fair to them, okay?
Yeah.
So it's not, if you come to a Medea movie looking for Schindler's List, I think you're going to be a little disappointed, right? But if you come looking for what it is, and I think that if critics would accept it for what it is, and also sit in an audience with who it's directed to, I think there'd be a different opinion. But in all fairness, you know, I look back on some of it. I can't even watch it. It's rough for me.
Really?
Yeah, oh my God. My first time directing Medea's Family Reunion, I can't even look at it. I'm like, I made so many mistakes in what I didn't know. So what I've tried to do with critics is look for truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's truth, I'll take it, I'll absorb it, I'll try and find it. And that's what's been important for me. But I don't know if they're ever going to get it.
Yeah.
But it's okay.
And then the other thing was that within the Black community, overwhelming, I mean, I don't know if there's a more popular person than you or / Medea, but does it grate on you when periodically there's somebody like Spike Lee or a few others who you'll get people that are giving you a hard time? They say this evokes, you know, your Mammy character or an Amos and Andy, or in Spike Lee's case, he was going on about, quote, coonery buffoonery.
Yeah.
Does this bother you? Why are they wrong?
Here's why they're wrong. Because back in the day of Amos and Andy and Step and Fetch It and those characters, they never had any power. They never owned the character. They never had any authority. What I've been on this whole journey of my life has been to take this character, to take these stories that my people love and grow my business into a force. You know, that's been my purpose. But if you look at Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes said that Zora Neale Hurston was a new version of the darkie because she spoke in the Southern dialect, you know. And this kind of thing goes on and on in our community, and it has for a very long time. If you are Black and you are not representing a certain polished section, educated section of the culture, then you're put into the Step and Fetch It category, you know. But if you're someone like me, coming from where I come from, I tell stories about, you know, the people I grew up with, my uncle with his ashy knees, my loud, obnoxious neighbor, Dorothy Taylor, who would stab her husband every Friday night and then call the police. You know, I'm telling you, my aunt who would shoot at her husband and call 911 and say, you better come get him, I'm getting ready to kill this son of I mean, those people are real.
Right.
And what I found with a lot of those critics when they say those kind of things is what they're telling me is that those people's stories do not deserve to be told, which is unfair,
mm-hmm.
which is wrong, flat out wrong. I think we all have the right to tell our stories. And I speak from my experiences and my journey, and all these people are a part of it. And you can say what you want about them, but they're real human beings. And as long as we're all breathing on this earth, we all have a right to tell our own stories, yes?
Sure.
Yeah.
And one thing that you don't get enough credit for, I think, is how many opportunities you've created for other people in the community, even out of the community. Yeah. I mean, I believe Idris Elba did his first movie film. with you.
Yeah.
Taraji, her first leading role with you.
She's been saying some great things about me, man. It's just really awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not even mentioning how many people work for you in Atlanta.
Yeah, right now it's about 400, but since we opened in January, over 1,000 people have come through the gates. That's with contractors, construction workers, and the union workers, and on the shows and everything. It's over 1,000 people have come through the gates.
Can you tell people what goes on there? Because basically, you are operating the equivalent of a Hollywood studio in Atlanta, which I don't know if there's ever been anything like this outside of Hollywood proper, where this is kind of thing goes on.
Yeah. I don't take the time to sit in that thought of it because it would probably overwhelm me. But what I wanted to do is just have a full service shop for myself, which I've had for like 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And now we've just moved into a place where after mastering how to serve myself in the business, we've moved into the Fort McPherson Army base that I just purchased. And we're going to turn it into we've already broken ground, actually, turning it into a full service studio for anyone who wants to come and shoot, anyone who wants to experience what it's like to film in Atlanta, which is pretty darn
terrific.
Great.
Yeah. This is over like 330 acres, right?
Yeah.
It's a big place.
330 acres. It is a big place. And when I first stepped onto it, I thought, wait a minute, this is overwhelming. Is this too much?
It's not like you were at a small place before, though, right?
It was 60 acres, yeah.
But and this was the former Delta Airlines campus.
Yeah, the former
Delta
Airlines
campus.
So
you don't do it small.
No. But even there, when I remember the first day I went there and saw it, I thought, this is too big. I'll never outgrow it.
Mm-hmm.
So I carry that thought when I saw Fort McPherson for the first time. I didn't think it was too big. I'd never outgrow it. I said, okay, if I'm supposed to do this, then let's go.
That's great. And so it'll be fully operational in 2017?
No, late 2017. This is the 16th. See what I'm saying? late 17.
Sure. What inspired you to create the art house banner, I guess, of Tyler Perry Studios, 34th Street Productions, which I think the first thing that came out of that was For Colored Girls, which you directed. What was the impetus for that?
Well, the first thing was Precious, actually. They found Precious and brought Precious to me at the film festival. I called Oprah and said, let's get on board with this. But 34th Street Films was my serious brand. It was my brand because I had painted myself into a great little corner with the Tyler Perry brand. People were like, this is all we're going to expect of this brand.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted a new brand that I could go out and do more festival type films, mm-hmm. more films that garnered more critical acclaim. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in that at the time.
And the other kind of offshoot that you've been heavily involved with, I think starting in 2011, I believe, was this partnership with the OWN network, Oprah's network, which it's got to be kind of surreal when you think about the fact that this is the woman who inspired you to do this in the first place, right?
Beyond.
And now you're producing the most successful content on her network.
Isn't that weird? Yeah, it's like she talks about a full circle moment. That's absolutely one. And what's so crazy is that all those years ago when I saw it, I always felt connected to her some kind of way. Mm-hmm. So not only that, you know, for us to have become great friends over this period of time, it's really awesome.
What's at the root of that? I know she also had a pretty tumultuous childhood and has the strength of spirit or whatever it is to have come through like you have. Why do you think you guys connect so much?
Our similarities are uncanny. It takes Gail to talk about them. It's just, and a lot of times when we notice things ourselves, how we see things, how we, you know, appreciate things, how we can give two different people the same advice. It was somebody recently asked me in the paper, and I didn't even talk to her about this. They asked, what was the most humbling thing that I do? And I said, clean up dog poop. And she was on the same list. They asked her what she did, and she cleaned up dog poop. You know, so we have a lot of things in common, and I think that has helped solidify a wonderful friendship.
Yeah. And she's one of the godmothers of your new baby, right?
Quite new, Well, 2 years old. He seems like a little man.
And in fact, probably not coincidentally, over the last 2 years, you've taken a bit of a break from directing until Boo. You have, however, appeared in a few non-Madea-related projects, and you mentioned Alex Cross, also very well-received in David Fincher's Gone Girl.
Yeah.
And so I just wonder, was that sort of to satisfy your own curiosity about what it's like working for other filmmakers, see how they work?
Well, the Star Trek, working with J.J. Abrams was the first time I was like, okay, let me see how everybody else works.
Yeah.
But with Fincher, I first of all, when you get an opportunity to work with somebody that brilliant, you have to say yes. I mean, what do you want me to do, play a rooster in the corner? I can do that for you, David. Yes, that's what it was about, seeing what other people were doing, but also about learning. Mm-hmm. I felt like I went to college on his set. And as I watched Gone Girl, I mean, it became a study for me as I watched it over and over again, and just the style and the lighting, and just, and I wanted to take that into another film. So that's why I hadn't made a film in a while, aside from my son was my focus, you know, in these first 2 years. But the next drama that I do, I think you'll see a lot of my appreciation for what I learned on that film.
From Fincher.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you compare and contrast your level of comfort and your level of enjoyment when you're playing Medea versus when you're playing somebody else for somebody else?
Well, for a long time, I couldn't do... I did a movie, Good Deeds, that I wrote and directed and starred in, to see if I could do it without a costume. I didn't know if I could. Mm-hmm. So that was allowing me to have a level of comfort to be able to do Alex Cross or Gone Girl. But I love being on other people's set because, you know, everybody else is in the trailer. I'm watching, I'm learning. I've got, what is that for? What are they doing that? Mm-hmm. And what's that lens? And why are you? And also because I have gotten to a point where I just want to explore, do some different things, and just be the best that I can at it.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of movies do you like to go and see?
I love sci-fi. I'm a big sci-fi fan. Yeah, one of my favorite movies is World War Z.
Yeah.
Before that, it was Aliens. Yeah, and they're working on a sequel. I'm sitting there just like this, like, where is it? Where is it, Brad? Where is it? Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that's been discussed a lot in the last couple of years, both of which the last 2 years have produced sets of acting Oscar nominees that did not have any people of color among the 20 acting nominees. One of the things that's come up is, why is this happening? Is it because the industry is not making diverse movies, or is it because the Academy is not diverse enough to accept those movies? I guess I'd love to know what your theory generally is, but also what's your interpretation of this argument, quote, black films don't travel, which it just means that overseas people are not showing up as much for movies built around black characters, black actors. What do you make of all of that?
Well, there are two separate questions there. One about Hollywood, Oscar so white, and the diversity. I never could really get into those arguments because I came in from the outside. I couldn't get into the, you know, let me stand here and pick it with you. It just, I came in doing my own thing. And because of that, I think it was the DGA reported that 1/4 of all diversity or something was because of me in cable television. I was too focused on making a change, to owning a studio, to having the power, to having the authority to hire people. That's where the change comes in. I'm not going to sit around a table saying, what do we do, going back and forth. I'm working. That's is what I'm doing.
And
so
creating chances for other people.
Yeah, that's what I knew that I was supposed to be doing. So I couldn't get into that argument. And personally, I just felt like, let me just do what I do. On the other side of it, the other side of your question, movies traveling, you know, it was Will Smith who, I told him, I said, listen, they're telling me that our movies don't travel around the world. He said, get on a plane and come over here to Europe with me. And I went to 4 territories with him, and the reaction was amazing. But, you know, granted, he's the biggest star in the world. But what he was explaining to me is that most of these territories are smaller than Texas. You've got to come, you've got to work them, you've got to get introduced to them. You've you can't just sit aside and say it doesn't work. You have to invest. Mm-hmm. And he started investing very early on in music, and it took years to build it, but it has to be built. So I think that someone in this industry is going to have to say, okay, I want to start building this abroad. I want to start building this type of entertainment abroad and make the investment. And then,
but
it'll
why
change.
Does that have to happen when that doesn't have to happen for, you know, David Fincher makes a movie, they doesn't have to do that. I guess because the thing that's just so weird to me is your movies couldn't be more successful than they are here.
Yeah.
And yet overseas, they don't make a lot of money.
Well, there's no effort to promote or sell them there, really. I have a friend of mine named Brendan O'Carroll who plays Mrs. Brown, which blew my mind when I found he's in Europe. He sells out arenas. He's on the BBC. He did a movie that did really, really well. It blew my mind, the similarities in our lives. I think where he's older than I am, but our birthdays are a couple of days apart. Mm-hmm. You know who I'm talking about?
I think so.
Oh my gosh, he's hysterical. Yeah. And he plays a woman.
Yeah.
And he's huge there. And when I was having this very same conversation with me, he's like, are you trying to tell me that Madea wouldn't work in Europe? No, let me show you something. So it's about educating and one person breaking through.
Are you interested in being that person?
Yes, but my focus has been so on building the studio and where I am now. I haven't had the energy or the time to really focus on it, but absolutely I could be. Yeah. Sure.
What would Medea have to say about the Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton election?
Well, honey, I could tell you on a few occasions. I just think that...
Are you okay? Are
you okay? That's great.
I just think that they need to do something, because this is just damn stupid. You got a man trying to run for president, want to build a wall, but hell, he need to build a wall around Trump Tower so I can lock his ass up in it. And Hillary, Lord, I love Hillary, but this is what I'm going to say about that. This is all I'm going to say that I'm going to be done with. Everybody say they want Donald Trump because he ain't no politician. Well, let me ask you something. If you about to have surgery and you need your brains worked on, would you go hire somebody just because they ain't a doctor? Hell, you need a politician in the White House to be a politician.
I heard that joke somewhere. I don't own that joke, but I heard it somewhere.
No, it's great. You should keep it.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
Thank you for that. That's awesome. So just, I guess, as a final question here.
Look, you're crying, man. Wipe your eyes.
I know. Give me a second here. Yeah. Oh, man. So again, whether it's with the Oprah element where things have come kind of full circle, or the fact that you're now one of the most commercially successful filmmakers, forget black filmmakers, and you've done really so much, as we've referred to with Atlanta and elsewhere, to help other people get a leg up in this business, it's got to be pretty kind of pinch me if you stop and think about that. And I just wonder, you're still a young man. What's left on the bucket list? What's there to do?
Now it's about growing the studio into what it's supposed to be, because I didn't ask for it. You know, I was going to build something on the other side of town. It's much smaller property. This is in the city of Atlanta. The level of responsibility that I have there, the level of responsibility that I have to all the employees and to all these other young filmmakers and people who want to be in the business. And it's a heavy burden, but I've got to honor it, respect it, do my absolute best with it, and then hopefully make it strong enough that it lives so long that I can pass it on to my son if he wants to do that, or any other young person who comes along and thinks that they want to take this to the next level.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.